Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to Teología Sin Vergüenza, queer and feminist theology from Latin America and its diaspora to get those spiritual justice juices flowing. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. You may not have heard from a lot of folks who live shamelessly as both queer, trans, feministas, and people of faith, but you're about to. Even if you don't know it, we are everywhere. We do our work in the academy, in the church, in our homes, and on the streets. We fight for our communities and for our own lives. We are not macho, but we are many. We're irreverent queer feminists who are shamelessly faithful, and we're faithful theologians who are shamelessly activistas. We are shamelessly las sinvergüenzas. We pluck the ripest fruit from the Bible to make juicy queer feminist Latina theology that refreshes your spirit and quenches your thirst for liberation. In this episode, you'll find delicious decolonial theology for the real world right now. So get your cup of coffee, pull up a chair, because you belong here. Now, let's get down to pleasure. Welcome to this episode of TSV. Today we sit down with Ana Laura Lopez, who is an organizer, minister, and the coordinator for Freedom Church of the Poor Care and Engagement. They are rooted in Guatemala and shaped by global liberation movements of poor and dispossessed peoples. Ana's work is grounded in dismantling capitalism, white supremacy, ableism, and patriarchy, with an unwavering commitment to collective liberation. They build community through trauma-informed, intergenerational, and disability justice-centered praxis, organizing people to remember, reclaim, and revel in their shared power, beauty, and belonging. Welcome. Hi, beloved. Welcome to Teología Sin Vergüenza.
Hello, hello, hi.
I am so excited to have you here. I feel like your voice is missing from our Sinvergüenza lineup, and now we are here and we have you, and I can't wait to get us started.
Thanks. I'm so excited. I've heard about you all, and now I'm here, so it's a coming home. It feels good.
Yes. Well, welcome, welcome, welcome. We're going to start where we always start, which is, do you identify as a sinvergüenza? Why or why not? But in the English season, we're asking folks to tell us, what does sinvergüenza mean to you? Do you have experience with that word? Especially because we might have folks in the audience this season who aren't familiar with that word or what it means. So let us know a little bit about sinvergüenzura and what your relationship is to it.
Yes, definitely consider myself a sinvergüenza. Well, I have to say, if you would have asked me that, like, even 3 months ago, I probably wouldn't have said it in the same way that I'm answering, yes, I'm a sinvergüenza today, like, unapologetically, like, full body, mind, soul, spirit.
Yes.
Because it wasn't really until, like, a month ago that I really felt that I was coming through this, like, exodus, like, this wilderness of my gender identity, my sexual identity, my intergenerational traumas to really tap into this like wholeness, into this full body liberation, acceptance, and like this real commitment to life amidst death dealing systems. Ooh. This commitment to liberation in my body and in my relationships with others, and really tapping into somebody that lives with chronic pain. So like from the depths of pain, choosing life, choosing myself and this body in this moment, and you know, saying yes to love and saying yes to all types of love, but especially romantic love.
Because okay, wait, what happened a month ago? Because I'm like, okay, you know, everybody listening is going to be like, wait, what happened? What happened? Was there a moment or was there a breaking point or what happened? Because that's amazing. We're getting you like right at this pinnacle moment of being like, yes, I am me and here, and I'm so delighted to be in that moment with you. But okay, but what happened? Tell us what happened.
Well, to all listening, it gets even better. No, it's just what's so nice about this moment is that I was taking a bath.
Yes. Okay. That's like a great start.
Nice. All right. I'm taking a bath because I'm in real pain, you know? And so it's like, it's a moment of self-care. It's a moment of being tender, of choosing to care for my body in the way that it needed to be soft and gentle. And so it's in this moment, in the intimacy of this body with water, just like as if, you know, we were born.
Yeah.
I have this moment when I say, nope. This is the body that I have. This is who I am. And this is who I am in everything, like who I am as queer, as non-binary, as an immigrant, as a woman of color, as somebody who lives with chronic pain. Like, this is me. Like, I have no other body but this. I have no other life but the one that I'm living in right now in this moment. So choosing myself felt like, just like starting this podcast, like a coming home, a coming to me, and a coming to me from like very aware of my relationship to ancestors and to ancestors like being told no or being made feel like they're less, being made feel small. And in this moment of me being in the bathtub, like seeing I am expansive. I am one with this water. I am one with, like, you know, divine spirit.
Yes.
And so that's what happened. And that was the moment where I also said, like, I had been wondering whether I wanted to be a mom and birth and, you know, queer. There's many complications and things to figure out, but my hesitance a lot of the time lately was more around living with chronic pain and whether I would be able to do it or not. But in that moment of choosing life and choosing myself and my body, I was like, I do want to be a mom in whatever way that will come about. I love kids. I love intergenerational relationships, and therefore like saying yes to this, saying yes to love and to bringing life on earth amidst, again, death dealing systems, felt like in this moment a radical act of love.
Absolutely.
And of choosing our people, our community, like to carry on the lineages of resistance that move through my body and our collective efforts of liberation. So that's what happened, and that's how I'm here.
Yes, it feels like so much ritual. Even, like, I think that's something that is so critical is that we always have access to ritual. We always have access to the divine. For me, ancestors live in the water. I've definitely had the experience where I was like going to do a talk and then like taking a shower, like literally getting ready for the talk and feeling the ancestors being like, that's not the talk you're giving today. We have other agenda items. You actually are going to shift. And that happens to me in hot water in particular, where I just feel so much more connected and so much ritual is done with water. And so I think it's so beautiful to hear your story of this, you know, moment with the divine in yourself and the water when you're your most vulnerable. I mean, baths are like, we're naked, we're in water, we're super vulnerable. And that you were having a moment of intense pain feels like is the exclamation point in your conclusions in that prayer world, in that like in between liminal space between you and God. I just feel like, yeah, felicidades, like that's good for you, like holding that. And maybe you could tell us just a little bit about what you're up to in the world, because when you were talking about death dealing systems, you're not talking abstractly about something theoretical over there in a different country or in a different group of people. You are in the midst of that work every day in your ministry, in your work. And so when you say the choice to choose yourself and choose our community and choose love and life in this moment where so many people are feeling the consequences of the death dealing system is a particular one, because it's right there with you. It's not those other people over there. So will you tell us a little bit about your work and ministry in the world right now?
Yes, would love to. So I'm an organizer. I am a minister with the Freedom Church of the Poor. And I say that, if y'all could see my smile, I say that with pride. I say that with my feet deeply grounded and rooted in the lineage of poor people organizing for a better world.
Yeah.
I have been working with the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice for about 5 years now. And they come from this lineage of the National Union of the Homeless, the National Welfare Rights Organization. It is everyday people like you and me, Latinas, Black, White, poor White, poor Black, poor Latinos, poor people living under this death dealing systems, but who have resisted and who continue to resist by coming together in community, by being led by the poor and the marginalized. And so it is from that lineage and from that reality today where we see the continued attacks to our Black, our Brown siblings who are incarcerated, who are living in the streets, who are being Medicaid for being cut from Medicaid, and who are saying another world is possible. You know, the current situation within the U.S. is just about to get worse. And so we've been traveling around the country, connecting with different communities who are showing us how it is that another world is possible, how it is that we live actually in a world of abundance.
Yes,
where absolutely every need of everyone could be met if we chose to do so.
That's
we,
right.
In the United States, throw away more food than it would take to feed not only everyone who's hungry across the U.S., but everybody across the world.
Yes.
So therefore, there is enough.
Absolutely.
We released a report that talks about, right before the pandemic, that there is 140 million people who are poor or who are just one emergency away from absolute economic ruin here in the United States. That was before the pandemic. Mm. So you can only imagine that that number has gone way up. And that is like 140 million is 43% of the U.S. population. And so that is power. That also reflects that poverty is not because of an individual's fault, an individual's misdoing, which is a lot of what we hear, like, oh, this yep. is the country of dreams, the country of opportunity. This is the country that, like, you can pull yourself off from your bootstraps.
Yes,
like, that's what we hear. That's the narrative, and that is not true. If you're talking about 43% of the population, then we're talking about systemic problem.
That's right.
And so, yeah.
Well, it made me think about also this word. I'm curious what your experience is with this word poor, because I come from Appalachia and I was raised by coal miner's daughter, literally. Mm-hmm. And we were poor, but we would have never said that out loud. Like, well, one, it was also Appalachia. So when we were just helping each other out, because it was that whatever crop it was, whether it was peaches or strawberries or beans or whatever, we just had tons of them and we would can them and do all these things. Yeah, and so in that way, that's how we got by. But I wonder, like, part of our issue and part of the systemic injustice is that nobody thinks they're poor. Like, literally nobody. Everybody's like, well, I'm lower middle class, or like, that's, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about your experience with that, or talking to folks, like, this idea that you have to sell your labor for money to meet your basic needs, that that's not just like an average middle class household. I just feel like that was a whole process for me that took forever. I still kind of flinch at the word poor, but I feel like that was, it was not untrue at all. And yet I had been given this narrative that, like, growing up on $13,000 a year, I mean, granted it was the 80s, but still $13,000 for two people was not enough money. And so that idea of, like, we were not middle class.
No, we're not.
There was, like, this fictitious idea that we're all middle class at some range. What's your experience with talking with people and you and having that be, like, explicitly what your organization is called or what the campaigns are called?
Two of my mentors, Reverend Dr. Lysthea Harris and Willie Baptist, wrote this article about who are the poor and why are they poor. And they really invite us basically to think about, if you don't have, I was going to say assets, that's not the right word, but, like, if you don't have money, like, if you're not in the 1%, basically,
right,
you're poor. Like,
which most of us know zero people in that 1%. Exactly. Even the richest person you know, who maybe has, like, a beach house or whatever, like, your parents, friends, even that's not even who we're talking about, right? Like, that's not even the 1%.
That's right. That's right. So if we're able to then understand that, then it's like, oh, snap, it's all of us, and that we're a part of this, like, economic system, like, that can be different. Like, capitalism hasn't been around forever. It's a new development. Therefore, like, we can think about something different than the current way of living and of relating with Mother Earth. And so there is such shame, and I'm choosing shame because, you know, we're talking about being sinvergüenza. And so it's like resisting to the shame of calling ourselves poor. It's so needed to be able to say, like, there is no shame in me being poor. I am poor because of this system. There's no relation to, you know, spiritualizing, like, poor in spirit or whatever. Like, no, none of that. Like, it's actually economic conditions, material reality of people. Yes. Like, God, like, Jesus was a poor man. Jesus was a homeless man. And so Jesus was organizing amongst the poor and marginalized and was aware of the economic, societal conditions of his time and was against those realities and was organizing for all of us to experience jubilee, which is like every need met because we know that God created abundance. And so there is definitely, like, everywhere we go, or, like, in, we get emails about, like, maybe you shouldn't use the word poor. Like, maybe you should use something else. And I'm like, no, that is exactly why we're using it, why we have to. And so that is, like, the lineage of the organization and the work that we're doing to really bring together those 140 million people in the US, but also building bridges of solidarity internationally for mm-hmm. all the ways that people are made poor. People are not born yes. poor. People are made poor by the systems we live under. And so it's a commitment to knowing that another world is possible and that there is enough for everyone.
I love that. And I was going to ask you, as a minister, what's the connection to, and you totally just read my mind, went there and was like, absolutely, this is directly in line with Jesus. This isn't even adjacent. This is like part of the gospel. And one of the things when we have talked before that you said is like, God is not neutral and God does not want us to be poor. God does not want us to be limited. You said, God is not neutral. God wants me to live fully. And mm-hmm. the idea that that is even possible, I think, is something that is hard for a lot of us to wrap our minds around. And then you have statistics that show us, like, actually, there is enough. It is about human will and human greed on the other side. That doesn't happen. So I just feel so grateful that you're like connecting those through lines because they're absolutely connected. And I wonder if I asked you before and I'll ask you again now, how did you get to be this badass organizer? Where did you come from? Who did you come from? Because I just feel like it feels like you've been doing this your whole life and you're like, I kind of have. And so I would love for you to tell us a little bit, like, what, especially when we're thinking about the bridging back to the places that we come from and home mm-hmm. And the lineages of resistance. I think there's so much that we in the US can learn from those of us who come from other places and what those struggles were and what those histories are that we're often not told. So will you tell us a little bit about your connection?
Yes, for sure. I was not created in a vacuum, you know. Mm-hmm. I am a part of a history yeah. of resistance, of a history of, I'll say resistance, and I'll talk about my mother. I know later on Las Sinvergüenzas always talk about what is her lineage, who forms us. And I'm thinking about my mother. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about my grandparents, but I'm thinking about my mother specifically because she is the daughter of, she has five brothers and it's mm-hmm. only her as the only girl. And, you know, she lived in a very chauvinist household, a very machista household. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I haven't said that I'm originally from Guatemala, from Antigua. If you haven't been there, you definitely should because it's absolutely gorgeous.
Yes, you should.
So I was born in Antigua. I was born in Antigua in 1991. That is just 5 years before we signed the peace agreements after 36 years of civil war. So I'm 5 years old when we signed the peace agreements. But before I'm even born, I was bringing up my mother because my mother said if she ever has a daughter, she doesn't want her to have the same life that she had, where she had to serve her siblings, where she had to literally have less food because the men needed to have enough food for themselves. Where when she was finishing high school or middle school, I guess, in Guatemala, she was trying to decide what she was going to study. And she decided what is known as home economics, like, mm-hmm. you know, that can be seen as a very traditional, like, women role, but she yeah. chose it because it was the one career that you have to travel to the city to study. Mm. She wanted to live her town. She wanted to see more. And yes. so she chose that because it got her out.
Yes.
And so this is a fierce woman, a sinvergüenza through and through, that then said, if I have a daughter, I want her to not have to go through the same circumstances. And so she has a son, my brother, who's 5 years older than me. And this is somebody who then loves to cook, loves to sew, loves to do then all the like female roles of society.
Yeah.
And then there's me who, for the life of me, I can can cook to survive, but like, sadly, I have not yet learned the lessons, the cooking recipes from my family. But I'm coming through this like lineage of resistance, of like immediate lineage with my mother. But I talked about the 36 years of civil war in Guatemala, and I talk about, therefore, a culture and a society filled with fear, filled with the trauma of war, of genocide, of erasure, of annihilation, of bodies, of culture, of language. And so I'm raised in that culture, with that awareness. And I come to, you know, we end up having to leave Guatemala when I am 14, just a couple of months before my quinceañera. And I arrive in, out of all places, Louisville, Kentucky.
Welcome to the South.
Just like a week before starting high school. I come into a church here that like is committed to justice, is connected to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which are amazing organizers in Immokalee, Florida, who are organizing for fair wages and for dignity in the fields. And so that's how I like, I come into organizing, into community building, like with them. And, you know, I organize through my high school years, then I organized through my college years in Asheville, North Carolina, where
that's where I'm from.
Yay. So we have connections to land, and to region in this country where, you know, there's a lot of hurt, there's a lot of racism. But there's a lot of resistance. Like on campus, we were organizing so that the few people of color who were there didn't have to drop out, but could continue in their studies and could finish their studies, because many of them were first generation students. And so there's all of this lineage of like of resistance, of building the world that we so desperately need in the everyday, in the ways that we relate to one another, in the ways that we share our resources, that then due to hurt and racism, I end up leaving the U.S. I end up going back to Guatemala, but I end up like coming together with other young people in a time of resistance and organizing in Guatemala to remove our precedent in 2015 that really taught me like the need for us to come together, meet each other's material needs, and organize to create societal change to meet the needs of our community. And so we were organizing like healthcare clinics and dental care work, and with like young people coming into different towns, connecting artists and organizers, and reclaiming the streets and the local parks to say, these are our streets, this is our space. Yes. And together we can make sure that elected officials, you know, like do the things that they promise every time that they are running for office, that we ourselves will put in the pressure, and just as we get them to do what they say they will do, we will meet the needs of our community. And so that is a lot of what has grounded my work. So we're doing this organizing of our material needs, organizing our communities to respond and to connect and to organize themselves and to scale, I guess, the organizing, because in some ways, like people were already caring for each other, but we're politicizing the way that they're caring for each other and why they're having to step in themselves in the ways that they're caring for each other. And what is the role then of government, of the society, to share the abundance of the world with their people. And so that's a little bit of like my politicizing that is happening in Guatemala, but this is all happening in a time and in a body, in my body, when I am also wrestling with heartbreak, where I'm also wrestling with mental health issues. And so there comes a moment where I break. And I break with a mental health crisis. And a friend who I deeply love, who I met through college, and who we have like this incredible otherworldly connection, immediately calls. And she's like, what are you about to do? Mm. And it's a moment of fear. It's a moment of being lost in pain that is both my own, but it's also communal. Mm-hmm. A pain of just knowing that more is possible, but that we don't have it. And so therefore yes. we're hurting in yes. such real deep ways. And she's like, I'm buying a ticket. You're coming to stay with me for a month. And so I leave Guatemala and I go back to, and I not go back to, and I go to LA actually. And I spend some time with her, just like being nurtured and cared and loved and being seen. Right. Yes. And so I say all of that because that leaves like a few months where like I then go to my parents and I'm cared by them and I share my journey with them too. And so, I don't know, I'm sharing this like organizing journey, deeply aware of I'm organizing for and with my community. I'm organizing yes. for this body, for myself, for my mother, for my grandparents, and for the many, many generations to come, aware of the living conditions that my body has experienced, that our collective bodies have experienced, and a deep commitment to a better world and to therefore like intergenerational care and resistance. And so that's a little bit of the organizing background that like then brings me back to the US, but I'll stop there.
Yeah, because I want to ask the next question, which is, okay, so that's the justice line, that's the organizing line, this work that you're such a badass at. Okay, now when does ministry come into it? I know that you're a PK, a preacher's kid.
That's right.
So was it inevitable that you be in ministry? So many, I think, of us who have a call to ministry either delay or deny that call because of our sexual orientation or our gender identity. And so I'm wondering about that journey. Like, so where does the ministry get interlaced into that organizing journey? Because now you're at this beautiful sweet spot of both being fully in ministry and fully in organizing. And it fits, it seems like from over here, like hand in glove, they go so smoothly and fluidly together. And you move so beautifully back and forth between the two centers and like make them make sense together. But like, how did you get to hear? How did you get to that point?
I feel like to others, it was clear. To me, as a PK, I feel like I grew up and I was like, oh no, I will never like, you know, go into the ministry in that way. But literally that 1 year where I'm in my mental health crisis, and especially many times before, but it's within that year where I'm meeting like random people and people are telling me I should go to seminary. And people had told me before and I was like, nah, it's not for me. That's my dad. and then I'm like in this moment of like, what is next? What am I doing with my life?
Yeah.
And then everybody's telling me I should go to seminary.
Seminary.
And I was like, man, seminary, really? But if I was to go to seminary, it has to be a seminary that is committed to justice. And so people start telling me about Union Theological Seminary here in New York. And I applied there and I applied to Louisville Presbyterian Seminary because that's where my dad studied. And so I get accepted to both. But then, of course, I wanted to go to Union. This long lineage of liberation theology. And
so, and like your mama going to the big city.
That's right. That's right. Yes, that is just wild. Just full circle again.
Yep.
Just, life works. And so I end up moving, but I end up moving, and I'll say this, like I end up moving at a time where I'm also moving through grief, because I had been one of the caretakers for my grandmother that last year. She was diabetic, had many complications, and so a cousin and I were caring for her. And I shared with her that I was going to move back to the States, and she was absolutely heartbroken. She understood, of course, as a devout Christian, me going to seminary was like an incredible gift, and like she was really proud. But she was really heartbroken that I was going to leave. And she was like, what am I going to do? Like, when am I going to see you? And, you know, I try to comfort, I try to like affirm that we would video call each other. And this is the reality, right, of migrants, of living between worlds, of not fully here, fully there, and being everywhere. Mm-hmm. Where, of course, I wanted to be with my grandma. Of course, I wanted to pursue a ministry. And so it's about like 2 weeks before I have to move that she continues to deteriorate to the point where she does pass away. And, you know, we celebrate her life, and I'm so conscious that like of our connection.
Yes.
And the heartbreak that she was experiencing. My nephew is born along that same, like within the month. There is also, there's like this life and death and grief and the opportunity. And so I arrive in New York with all of that in 2019, August of 2019, just before the pandemic. And so I'm moving with this grief and with this also in some ways reclaiming of who I am, of this tapping into ministry and spirit and the divine in my life telling me yes to go down this path. I really wanted to learn more about chaplaincy. Sadly, you know, we were talking about economic systems before, and for chaplaincy you have to do
CPE
during your studies, but it's a time where you can't get paid. You do work. Right. And so
that's why I didn't do it also.
That's right. Like I couldn't do it. I had to
work. Who could do that?
Exactly. I had to work to pay for my housing and for my food. Yes. I was just coming from Guatemala. There was nobody to provide living in New York but myself. And so I was never able to pursue that. But I did find the Cairo Center, and I did my internship with them. And they helped me understand the economic conditions that we were living under, this moment, and how important it is for us to come together across the many lines that divide us, whether it be race or gender or sexuality, but to come together and to read the Bible and to create a world with all of our connected resistance. This is how I end up in seminary. I do think that a part of me being queer, me being non-binary, definitely pushed back against me going into ministry. After high school, I left the church for about 10 years, just knowing that like I wasn't welcomed for who I am, or that was my understanding at that point, to like being like, no, wait. God is love. God is created abundance. God created you and me in this fierce, sexy, queer self. Like God is all of this, right? So therefore, like, I want to know more about this God, more about this lineage of like, of love, of abundance, of liberation. And I want to be able to share this with others, especially, yes, within the Latinx community, but like anyone who's hurting, anyone who has been told that they're not created in the image of God, when we know we are, when we know that God is everything, is God is queer, you know?
Like prove me wrong.
So that is how I connected my two worlds.
Yeah.
And you know, recently, even with Kairos, like, we continue to hold our Pride services in the month of June, and even just this past season, like, we were really wanting to study the texts of terror that have been weaponized against us, to say, like, you know, some of those texts are not here to be saved, like, they're problematic and they're just hurtful, and others, like, have just been weaponized to annihilate us when that is not what they were intended for. That is the walk that I'm on now, like, continuing to learn more about the Bible, to learn more about God, and to continue to create the world that we so desperately need, but the world that God intended to be, a world of justice, a world of love, a world of abundance. And so here to do all of that.
All of that, yes. And I want to talk a little bit more about your ministry of presence. I think that's so beautiful to think about how, what it means and how it is to be with people, particularly in this moment. I feel like there's so much spiritual terrorism in this moment. And there is something so critical and yet so understated about ministries of presence and rituals of, you and I have talked, and you were talking about building containers where we get to meet the divine in ourselves, the divine in others. And I'd love for you just to talk about, like, do you have an example of something you've been thinking about recently, or something you've done, or what does that ministry of presence mean to you, particularly in this political moment?
Thank you for bringing that in. When I talk about ministry of presence, I always go back to me being 5 years old. And maybe as you're listening to this, you did not see how I was going to jump back to me being 5. But it's because when I was 5 years old, living in Guatemala, my parents visited an elderly home, and they met this woman who was terminally ill and who had been abandoned by her family. And, you know, during their time together, they ended up offering if she wanted to come to her home. Of course, when you are seen, when you are, like, loved, when, like, someone's home is open up for you, you say yes wholeheartedly. Mm. So she was excited. She was grateful. And so she moved to our home. It was a parish home that we were living in at the time. And I, to this day, remember running down the stairs into her room and simply sitting in her bed. I cannot tell you what we talked about, but I can tell you that we were present with each other, that we saw each other, that we valued each other, that we practiced a ministry of presence. And so, I'm 5 years old, she did end up dying in our home. And that really is what now, as I reflect back, like, that's what leads me then on this path and in this ministry of just showing up, of being with people, of seeing people, of caring for one another, and of understanding how it's done in the everyday, in lo cotidiano, we would say in Spanish. It's in the everydayness where we have the opportunity, all of us, to build containers, to meet the divine, to meet one another, to create this intergenerational relationship, this interdependence with all that is living, and to create a different world. Like, we're bombarded with death-dealing systems that traumatize our bodies, and therefore that limit from our trauma the ways that we're able to relate to one another, that limit therefore our imagination. If we are able to, like, I was going to say simply, but it's not. It's simple.
No, it's hard.
But it's hard. It's simple.
It requires a leap.
Yes. It requires, like, a surrender, though. A surrender to to what we're like, if you're an organizer, it's you surrendering to the world that you're organizing for. And the organizing for is not a future thing. It is a thing that is here. And so a ministry of present is like fully aware of the world that I'm headed towards, but that I am inhabiting here and that I'm practicing here. When you were asking about like rituals that, or like ways that I've practiced this or spaces that I've created, it makes me think about the rituals around Dia de los Muertos, that in recent years I've been able to craft and co-create and hold with many others that are part of Freedom Church of the Poor, that you can also learn more and read, because we are releasing a book actually on September 8th called We Pray Freedom. It is from Freedom Church of the Poor that holds a little bit of these rituals. With Dia de los Muertos, it was this commitment to creating a container where we could grieve communally. This culture, though we are living through death-dealing systems, we don't have systems or containers or practices to communally grieve the different ways that are being oppressed, the different ways that our communities are dying. And it's, for Dia de los Muertos, there's an element of celebrating life that is crucial as we hold each other in the depths of our pain. I think that creating this this rituals of remembrance to like serve as a bridge for our social movements to be able to connect to tradition, to to other generations, to other cultural practices that are able to hold the liminality of life and death, because we can't fully birth or live into this world of abundance and life if we don't also hold and nurture and care the pain and the grief and the trauma that our bodies are carrying, not only for the atrocities of this moment, of the evil of this moment, but everything our bodies and our ancestors have lived through in the past. We have to be able to not just reckon, but care, be tender and be caring to our bodies and our spirits today, to therefore create and embody the world that we want for ourselves tomorrow and for the many generations to come. And so Dia de los Muertos has served as an opportunity to pause, to remember, to resist, to recommit to this work of justice. Totally embedded and grounded in a practice and a ritual of ancestors. So there's this like dance and liminality of you're here, but you're connected to the past and you're connected to the future. That I think specifically rituals are able to help our bodies. I was going to say understand, and there are elements that we understand and that our mind understand, but there are elements that our bodies can just know that the ritual creates the container for us to at least surrender for our bodies, our spirit to experience.
Yeah, that makes me think of home and diaspora. And I'm wondering for you, we've been talking a lot this season in Teologías de Vergüenza because we're focused in the diaspora and in English this season, in the U.S. specifically. We've been talking a lot about home and what does home mean and what does home feel like. And so I'm curious for you, who has lived now in many places and who travels to find more of our people all over, what feels like home, or who feels like home, or where feels like home, all of those things. And And does it feel like you are in diaspora? What is that experience like for you?
Because my dad is a pastor, it has meant that we have moved a lot. It is only my first 8 years of life that I've lived in one place. And then it's almost every year that we have moved. My parents always taught us that home is wherever we are. Mm. That we make our own paradise wherever we are. And so home for me is many places, is many people, is both the people and the places that I know and the and people and places that I don't know, but that I know that others have walked, that therefore have informed my body. And so with that awareness, home is here, home is now, and home is something I can't even fully name, but I deeply experience. And this is this surrender with the divine, is this surrender with knowing that I'm cared for, knowing that I'm held at all times. Home is my faith in that. It feels like laughter. It feels like playing with or walking in nature with a two-year-old picking up a stick and like walking alongside an ant. You know, like it's that wonder of the world as me being this like tiny speck in it, in this like world, but in it in like in history of like there was a before, there is a now, and there will be a future. It's this like awareness of like I'm made out of stardust, right? Like home is wonder, is therefore like that surrender to that wonder. Home is like safety and belonging and dignity and justice. I definitely feel it when I'm out on the streets, arm in arm with others who are chanting, who are singing, who are day in and day out figuring out how we create the world that we so desperately need. It is in that like interdependence and interconnectedness to all that is living, to all that is resistant and birthing life, that I think I find home. I see myself in it, a part of the whole. I feel it in my body as part of many things, as part of the cosmos, as part of a lineage that has resisted and will continue to resist.
Wow. Whew, what an incredible conversation. I want to end us with the question that we end all of our episodes, which is the continuation of this conversation about lineage. I feel like you've shared with us about your mom and about your grandma and place that you come from. And so in those moments when you need reminders of who you are and whose you are and where you come from, who are those ancestors, whether they're thinkers or theologians or cultural icons or family members, like what is that fount of restoration and remembrance? Who are those cloud of witnesses the closest to you?
I love this question. And I love this question because it's a constant reminder that we are not alone. It's this reminder that we're doing this with many others, and that we're standing in the shoulders, that we're standing alongside like many others who have resisted. And I think therefore living of my mom, who still to this day is like, you know, trying to unlearn the machismo that has been passed down, like trying to learn how to slow down, that it's okay for her to slow down and to rest, that she doesn't need to be serving everyone all the time, that she can choose herself and what brings her joy, you know, like, then I do this work, like, I never came out to my grandma, the one that I was like really well, okay, I've never come out to, it's only two cousins who know about me back home in Guatemala. Mm-hmm. And so definitely my grandma did not know. But I do this work and I tap into fully who I am so that she can be liberated too, from yes. anything and all the ways that made her feel that she needed to be any less than her full self. Yeah. And I think about Gloria Anzaldúa, you know, mm-hmm. who once said, I changed myself, I changed the world. That's right. And so like that awareness of, it comes back to my body, it comes back to this like everydayness and lo cotidiano of me practicing the world that I want to see in the way that I move through the world right now. Being aware of like those liminal spaces, those borderlands that we're crossing all the time, and that yeah. as you and I were saying at some point too, like the things are not like black and white, that mm-hmm. there's a lot of gray, and so there's a yes. lot of queering, right? There's mm-hmm. there's this expansiveness to our understanding of ourselves, to our understanding yeah. of our relationship to Mother Earth, to this ability to therefore like imagine and deconstruct and therefore construct and transform the structures that we're living under so that we are able to all tap into the abundance of the world. And I think too about like Audre Lorde yes. and the ways that she talks about like caring for herself, not as self-indulgence, but as a form of political warfare, of just yes. like the ways that we care for each other, but we care yes. for each other in relationship to the other, is like what I'm connected to, what I'm tapping into to continue to love myself, love this body, and more connected to Guatemala. I'm also thinking about Las Abuelas de Sepúr Sarco, which are the grandmothers of Sepúr Sarco, which is this community in El Estor, Guatemala, who were sexually abused during the Civil War and who took to court and won, like, being able to persecute at least two of the men that caused so much harm to yes. them, to their communities, who helped disappear, you know, many of like the men in that community, but like in Guatemala overall, like, and where we saw just through their fierce love to their community, how justice can persevere in some element, yeah. in some ways. And so I think about them, like just their fierce commitment to justice, to something else. And to all the women, to all the gender non-conforming bodies that day in and day out are like willing to try new things, like willing to yes. learn and commit to our full connection with life, that can therefore birth a world of where every, we say in the movement, we say, if you lift from the bottom, everybody rises. Like a world where we commit to building at the grassroots level from the bottom yeah. up so that everybody has access to the world's abundance. And so I'm thinking of them and I'm carrying them into this space and into this work.
Oh, yes, I want to be in this work with you also. I think this is just a really important theological framework to put on top of justice work, because many of us were taught that justice or social issues or politics were something over there and that we as Christians didn't touch them. And those of us over here who are saving up our treasures for heaven shouldn't mm-hmm. touch those things. And I think you are the perfect example of how those things live together all the time anyway. And so tending to both the spirit and the body and the material and connecting those dots for people and being in deep care and love and community with each other is so Christian and so important. And so I just feel like you are a perfect example of the best of Las Sinvergüenzas. And I'm so, so grateful for your time and for you being with us today.
Thank you so much. Yes, we're in this lineage together.
That's
so
right.
Really grateful for that and for all who are listening and continuing to resist and continuing to be fully unapologetically sinvergüenzas.
Amen. Thank you for joining us today for Teología Sinvergüenza. I'm Reverend Alba Onofrio, but you can call me Reverend Sex. Let us know what resonated for you from today's conversation and make sure to like, subscribe, and share this episode with someone in your life who might need it. Check out all of our other juicy content on this channel and find us on social media at soulforce.org or Teo Sin Vergüenza in Spanish. Cuídate mucho and remember, we are las sinvergüenzas. Are you one of us? Oh, sí, 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 sí.
Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sinvergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee. Whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.